We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a wonderful show for you. In this half hour of the show, we will be rebroadcasting an interview with Mr. Scott Seligman, wrote a book called The Great Kosher Meat War of 1902. It was fascinating. I love that book. It's really great, and that's why we're doing it again. In the second half of the show, we will be featuring the portion of the week, which is the portion of Ki Savo, which can be found in chapter 26 and following in the book of Deuteronomy. We're 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. We'll throw some of that in. We do have some Rosh Hashanah music in the show and other types of music sprinkled throughout the show. A wonderful story at the end, quite poignant. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. IDF soldiers came under fire in Jenin after an arrest of a wanted terrorist. 4 Palestinians were killed. Israel's Iron Dome intercepted a missile from Gaza. Israel has yet to respond. Despite the rockets, Israel is now allowing shipments of building materials into Gaza. Israel recalled its ambassador to Poland and instructed Poland's ambassador to Israel to extend his summer vacation after the Polish president signed a law that limits the time a victim of the Holocaust can reclaim stolen property to 30 years, which would mean 1977. A massive forest fire destroyed close to 10 square miles of forests north of Jerusalem. It took Israeli firefighters close to a week to bring the blaze under control. Thousands of people were evacuated from their homes. 2 17-year-olds were arrested and charged with arson. Shmuel Silverberg, a 19-year-old Orthodox yeshiva student in Denver, was shot and killed while standing outside his school building. Police are saying he was an innocent bystander of a carjacking and not racially motivated. 4 suspects were arrested and a 5th one is sought. Zvulun Simintov, the last remaining Jew in Afghanistan, announced that he will be leaving after the high holidays. There were close to 40,000 Jews living in Afghanistan in 1900. And finally, Israel's economy grew by 15.5% in the second quarter of 2021 compared to a 12.2% in the U.S. And that's the news. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We have on the line Mr. Scott Seligman. He is an author, historian, a journalist. He's written many books, and the articles appear all over the country in various publications. Has recently come out with a book called The Great Kosher Meat War of 1902, Immigrant Housewives and the Riots That Shook New York City, published by Potomac Books, which is an imprint of Nebraska University Press. Thank you so much, Mr. Zelligman, for coming on.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
It's great, great to hear from you. Just to let people know, a Lanceman, and just a very cute interlude before we get into the book is, we got the book last Friday. So Friday night, it was a long Friday night. I took the book. I said, oh, this is interesting. I never heard of the Great Kosher Meat Wars. Hadn't heard anything about it. And I'll talk about that. And as a rule, I never read the acknowledgments because I don't care. It's just, you know, people thank their mother and their grandmothers and the publisher and this person who helped them. And it just doesn't interest me. It never has. For some reason, I read the acknowledgments. The acknowledgments were actually interesting. And then I get down to the bottom of the page and I saw the name of my brother there. And it turns out that we're Lanceman. You grew up like three blocks away from me and in Newark way back when. And so it's a really cute connection. So, okay. Now, the this meat boycott was something that for some reason never really hit the history books. I went to a very good public school in New Jersey and had AP history. And we did an extensive section on the development of the labor movement in the United States. And the real emphasis started over there with the shirtwaist strike in 1907, and then the development of the International Ladies Garment Workers with Samuel Gompers and taking it from there. Nothing about the meat wars. So what is the deal, Scott, with meat wars?
Well, this, as you know, was several years before the shirtwaist strike. This was a very, very early example of Jewish female homemaker activism. In fact, it really was the first. You got to go back to early 20th century. This was the era of the trusts. You know, you've heard of the Railroad Trust and the Standard Oil Trust and the Steel Trust. There was, in fact, a meat trust or a beef trust that was developing in the Midwest, centered in Chicago. And these were folks with names that you may have heard of, like Armour and Swift. And they were essentially trying to corner the national market for meat by negotiating lower prices with the cattlemen, getting kickbacks from the railroads, controlling the amount of meat that was shipped to the cities of the East, and ultimately gouging consumers. Everyone was affected by it. And in fact, the administration of Theodore Roosevelt was trying to bust them under the Sherman Antitrust Act. But nobody was hit harder than the Jews of New York City. And the reason for that was that kosher meat, of course, was more expensive. But it was more expensive for more reasons than you talk about today.
Obviously, let me just interrupt. That was always a thing with people in keeping kosher, was mm-hmm. that kosher meat till today is very much more expensive than non-kosher meat. I look at the circulars and I see that non-kosher chicken you can get for 99 cents a pound. And for me, it's costing 3 1/4 a pound. So this has always been a complaint. So this is going back historically. But you say that it was probably more justified 100 years ago as to why the expense. So explain about the difference in the processing of kosher meat right. over, say, the industrial non-kosher meat, Scott.
Well, during this era, most of the meat that was sold in New York was actually slaughtered in Chicago or another town in the Midwest and then sent east. And the reason for that was they could send the carcasses in refrigerator cars. And it was a lot cheaper to send a carcass than it was to send a whole steer. But this was not appropriate for the Jewish community because in this period, the final step, the koshering, was done in the home by the housewife, the soaking and the salting. And you couldn't get it there. You couldn't get the meat there within 72 hours. So the meat for the Jewish community had to be shipped on the hoof and then slaughtered in New York. So for various reasons, it was a lot more expensive. And so the Jews were the first to really feel the brunt of this price increase, which went up in early 1902, fully 50%. So a pound of flan that had been going for 12 cents a pound all of a sudden cost 18 cents a pound. And for families whose income was $2 a day, maybe $10, $12 a week. That was a major, major jump. And it put kosher meat out of the reach of a lot of people who were observant and would not eat any other kind of meat.
Okay. So how did this response develop? Because the idea of a boycott 100 years ago was, I don't know how prevalent boycotts were, you know, from the civil rights movement in the 50s in Selma, Alabama, about boycotts. Were there other boycotts that somebody said, oh, you know, they did a boycott for this, we should do a boycott for this also?
Well, I don't think boycotts were entirely unknown to the Jewish community, just from Europe. I mean, Jews were often the subject of boycotts in Europe. But what happened here first was that the kosher butchers on the Lower East Side saw the problem coming. They knew that their customers, who were mostly women, were not going to be able to afford meat at those new prices. So they took the lead. They shut down for several days in order to pressure the wholesalers into lowering the prices. And they got some modest concessions out of the wholesalers. But when they reopened, instead of lowering the price, they actually raised the price of meat.
Not very smart.
Well, it wasn't smart at all because they lost the trust of their customers. And the day that it happened, a woman named Sarah Edelson, who was running a saloon on Monroe Street, she called a meeting of her friends to decide what they were going to do about it. And she expected about 50 people to come. Instead, 500 people showed up.
This is on the Lower East Side of New York, right?
Yes, Lower East Side of New York. And a woman named Fannie Levy stood up, and she was absolutely derisive about the butcher's strike because it had been so ineffective. And she said, this they call a strike? She said, let the women make a strike, then you'll see a strike. Now, of course, it wasn't a strike. It was a boycott. But they borrowed terminology from the labor movement. People who crossed their picket lines once they finally got them set up were called scabs. And they used the terminology. But after this meeting, the very next morning, in the wee hours, some 3,000 people, mostly Jewish women, took positions up on the Lower East Side on every block where there was a kosher butcher. And their instructions were to try to stop people from buying meat by reasoning with them. But when people crossed their lines and went in and bought meat anyway, that's when all hell broke loose. And women would grab the meat from grab the purchase from the woman who just made it, throw it into the gutter, and pour kerosene on it so it couldn't be consumed. They realized that they all were in it together, and if anybody bought meat, it was going to destroy the whole movement. So nobody could eat meat as far as they were concerned.
How many? There were probably about 500,000 or so Jews living in the Lower East Side at the time. How many butcher shops were there?
There were probably about 600,000 Jews. That's the number that I've seen. And there were about 600 butcher shops at this point.
Just in the Lower East Side?
Some blocks had more than one.
I don't think there are 600 blocks in the Lower East Side.
Well, like I say, there were blocks with more than one.
Indeed. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Scott Seligman. He's written a really wonderful book called The Great Kosher Meat Wars of 1902, Immigrant Housewives and the Riots That Shook New York City. Now, you use the word riots in your subtitle. Tell us about the riots that happened.
Well, once the women started confiscating meat, it got violent. The police were called. And butchers who refused to close also received the wrath of these women. Windows were broken. Meat was thrown into the street. Fixtures, in some cases, were destroyed. Occasionally, there were small fires that were set. And hundreds and hundreds of policemen were called in. And they were indiscriminate in their use of their billy clubs. They beat a lot of women. They sent a lot of people to the hospital. And they sent a lot more to jail. But what was unusual about this, because the relationship between the Jewish community and the police was not good at this point, mostly because the police were constantly bashing heads during strikes, during unionization. But this was something new. This was women who were getting beaten up by the police, and that was unseemly in 1902.
That would seem unseemly anyway for a big old strapping policeman to start hitting billy clubs on women that are not armed. But so how long did this strike boycott want for, Scott Seligman?
It basically went for 2 or 3 weeks before it was finally over.
And what was the ramification? What happened?
Well, there were sort of several steps in between. The women set up an organization, the Ladies Anti-Beef Trust Association. But then they reached out to a lot of the other organizations in the Jewish community, the synagogues, the Landsmannschaft, the Mutual Aid Society, things like that. So eventually MET kind of infiltrated the management of this thing, and they set up a coalition. And it was the men who more or less negotiated a truce, I guess you'd call it, with the wholesalers. The whole purpose of raising the prices had been to increase profits, and since nobody was buying meat, that wasn't happening. So basically, the wholesalers agreed to lower their prices for a while. They didn't specify a period of time. And that was enough to get some of the butcher shops reopened.
Okay, so now the ramifications of this boycott were very much far-reaching, because I'm looking through the book, it seems like this is what set the seeds for the labor movement in the Lower East Side and the dissolving of the sweatshops and labor unions and workers' rights. But tell us about the connection between not buying meat and Samuel Gompers and the International Ladies Garments Workers Union.
Well, you don't want to overstate it, because the unionization movement actually started before this. And in fact, the women borrowed some lessons from the union movements. But the difference was that if you're unionizing a factory, you know where everybody is. You know how to call a meeting. You know how to explain to workers that if they strike, they're going to and work together, that they can get more money. But this was community organizing. This wasn't unionizing. There were hundreds of thousands of people who needed to get reached and needed to understand why the process was going on and what they needed to do about it. And that was new. They used the newspapers, they used handbills, they knocked on doors. And these tactics were explicitly cited later on when there were tenant strikes, which began the next year, and to a lesser extent in some of the labor actions that you referred to. But interestingly, it was the tactics that were remembered. It was not this strike. By the 1920s, 1930s, nobody talked about this anymore. And it wasn't really rediscovered until 1980 in a seminal article written by a professor of Jewish history at Yale named Paula Hyman, who left us with a 14-page journal article about it. But I got interested in it, and I decided that there were more questions that needed to be asked about it. And that's why I jumped in to try to write a book about it.
Okay, now, one of the ramifications, again, our guest today is Scott Seligman, written a book called The Great Kosher Meat War of 1902. The emergence of a meat cooperative that was seemed to be, like, instead of run by a butcher, was run by a bunch of ladies. Uh-huh. Now, so the way a butcher shop used to run, nowadays, it's like no big deal. They get boxes of meat in their little packages, and they put them on the shelf. Back then, they used to get the forequarter, which weighs about 300 pounds, and it was a butcher's job to cut off all the forbidden fat and pull out the veins and to cut it down into pieces of meat. So were there ladies who picked up on this?
No. The ladies opened several of these shops, but they weren't the butchers.
Okay.
They employed the butchers. A lot of these butchers were out of work because their shops had been closed. And some of the butchers that the women claimed had been oppressing them actually showed up with their hands out looking for jobs. So that's how it happened. And because they were not for profit, because they were cooperative, they could afford to sell meat a little more cheaply and to buy in much larger quantities, which allowed them to get better rates out of the wholesalers.
Okay. How long did they last? Because I don't remember ever hearing about cooperative meat.
Not very long. People talked a good game about it, and there were plans for hundreds of these shops to open up all over the Lower East Side. As a practical matter, I only know of about two or three of them. And within 3 or 4 years after the strike, they had completely disappeared.
Leaving us back to the hands of the butcher. And okay, indeed. There was one other question I wanted to ask, which fell out of my head. I'm just so enthralled with this topic. You said you had a lot of questions that you needed to answer for yourself. What were some of those questions?
Dr. Hyman never dealt with the question of why the price of meat went up in the first place. Okay. And so that was part of what my research. But there was another piece of the story, which was quality of the meat. There was a lot of suspicion on the Lower East Side at this point that the meat that was being sold as kosher was not all kosher. And the reason for this, they assumed it were corrupt rabbis who were being paid by the meat processors. In the old country, they were paid by the kahal, the Jewish community, and they answered to a rabbi, and they could be the meshkichim could be fired. But in America, New York didn't have one Jewish community; it had lots of Jewish communities. It was quite balkanized, and so there really wasn't a central authority there. And these guys were paid by the meat houses, and there was a lot of incentive on the part of the meat houses to cheat. And so the ostensible solution was to try to appoint a chief rabbi of New York. And this was a man by the name of Jacob Joseph, mm-hmm. who came over in 1888. He had several reasons to come over. They wanted him to oversee the Beis Din, and they also wanted him to oversee education of children. But primarily, they wanted him to rationalize the kosher meat supply. And he was, frankly, utterly defeated in the process. He came up with the idea of the plumba, the lead seal that you attach to the leg of a chicken that shows that it was slaughtered under his supervision. But the women of the Lower East Side rejected it. They felt that it was just a money grab. They didn't see that it was something that was protecting them. And he eventually had a series of strokes and couldn't work anymore. And then there's one chapter in the book about his funeral, which was probably the scene of the greatest anti-Semitic incident New York has ever seen.
Could you go into that?
Sure. Well, he died just about a month or so after this kosher meat strike had ended. And New York seemed to be interested in giving him the send-off in death that they had, the honor in death that they had denied him in life. And there were hundreds of thousands of people showed up for his funeral. In fact, they were going to, there was no synagogue building big enough for a service. So they actually set up a funeral cortege and stopped at six of the larger synagogues on the Lower East Side for prayers. But it was on the final approach to the pier, because he was going to be buried in East New York on Grand Street, that the cortege passed a factory. It was a printing press factory, Gentile run and Gentile owned, and mostly Gentiles worked there. And the people were crowded into the street. There was no room to move around. And some of the workers in the factory started throwing things on the mourners. It got very, very bad. The police were called in. And rather than deal with the source of the problem, the police started beating up the Jews. Lots of people went to the hospital. There was an investigation later, because the mayor of New York at that time was not Tammany Hall, he was a reformer, and he had gotten in office largely as a result of Jewish support. But nobody was really punished for it. But I don't think New York has ever seen anything of that magnitude before or since.
Wow, incredible. Okay, that's going to wrap it up for us. I always ask when any author who just came out with a book, what are you working on for your next book?
Well, I'm still looking for a topic, to tell you the truth. I do have one coming out next year, but it's not about the Jewish community. This is my first book about the Jewish community, but it won't be my last.
Okay, wonderful. You'll keep us apprised. Again, our guest today has been Scott Seligman, the great kosher meat war of 1902, Immigrant Housewives and the Riots That Shook New York City. It's a great read. It's from Potomac Books, which is Nebraska University Press, available wherever you purchase your Jewish books. And Scott, thank you so much for coming on, and have a happy Hanukkah.
Thank you. You too. Chatzameach.
Okay. Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's MI for Michigan, KO for kosher, and SUP for supervisors, mycosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Up for your listening pleasure next, this is Yaakov Shweki. He's been quiet as of late, but he's making a comeback. Coming back up, the song is called Fighter.
Why are we all so far apart? Tired of fighting a war I didn't start. But this is my life, and that's just life. They say another day follows tomorrow, but who knows what's in store for tomorrow? It all seems too rough. Haven't we been through enough? Close my eyes, take a moment, take a moment. Just try to breathe. Then I see if I push, I can make it if I just believe. I've been through everything and after all, me down away from the line I choose. I know I am a fighter. I've been through everything and after all I've been through, nothing can push me down away from the line I choose. I know I am a fighter, a life worth fighting for. Why are we so far, far, tired of fighting a war I didn't start, but this is my life, and that's just life. Close my eyes, take a moment, take a moment, just try to breathe. Then I see if I push, I can make it if I just believe. I've been through everything and me down away from the life I choose.
New Year approaching, why go anywhere else for your holiday shopping when you can go to The Grove? Fully renovated, The Grove is located on Greenfield Road, just south of 696. At The Grove, you'll find the largest selection of kosher foods and wines in Michigan. Looking for fresh, round holiday challahs, honey cake, or exotic fruit for the new year? The Grove has it. The Grove has the freshest produce, gourmet dairy, deli, and meats. They even have a kosher bakery and hot takeout right on the premises. It's The Grove on Greenfield Road and 696 for all your shopping needs. Herschel Finman here, listening to the Jewish Hour. The song we're coming up next is a group called BART, and it's all capital letters. I'm thinking they're from San Francisco, but I could be wrong, because BART stands for Bay Area Rapid Transit, and musicians have a tendency to stand like in subway stations and open up a
music case and get some change that way. But this is Bart, and this is called A Klezmer Melody. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, Rosh Hashanah is coming up in a couple of weeks. This is a Rosh Hashanah parody. It is called. It's done by Ezra Cohen. It's called "Apples and Honey Are Good." And on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, it is customary to take a sweet apple and dip it in honey, that we should have a sweet and fruitful new year. Let's listen.
Apple. noodles and honey are good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. I got so many at home, It's been a long, long year for Jews everywhere. Now the holiday season is in the air. I'm singing like I can't wait for the New Year feast tonight. Cause in 10 more days, we won't eat a bite. Yom Kippur like, oh baby, oh maybe. Could stop this year right, baby. My king has already got all of my love. So apples and honey are good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. I've got so many at home, and if I stay, I might just eat them all. Apples and honey are good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. So I've got a bit of ado. May your year be sweet and new. Another, but I probably should not. I've got so many at home, and if I stay, I might just eat them all. Apples and honey are good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. So I've got a bit of ado. May your year be sweet and new. Sweet and new. Good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. I've got so many at home, and if I stay, I might just eat them all. Apples and honey are good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. So I've got a bit of a do. May your year be sweet and apples and honey are good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. I've got so many at home, and if I stay, I might just eat them all. Apples and honey are good. Wanna tip another, but I probably should not. So I've got a bit of a do. May your year be sweet.
We all know there's an opiate epidemic, but Advanced Rapid Detox has a solution for people addicted to pain pills, heroin, and dependent on Suboxone and Methadone. Advanced Rapid Detox performs detox under sedation in the hospital. Patients sleep through withdrawals and wake up without cravings. Dr. Julia Aronoff and the staff at Advanced Rapid Detox help people restore their lives and the lives of their families. Addiction affects everyone, even in the Jewish community, and Advanced Rapid Detox is there to help. Call 800-603-1813. That's 800-603-1813. Or visit them online at www.advancedrapiddetox.com. Harry Schulfenman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Kisavo, which we're reading in the synagogue. Is chapter 26 and following in the book of Deuteronomy. Most of the portion are the 98 curses that Moshe warned the people would happen for disobedience. And we've talked about those before, that it's not really saying this is going to happen, but it's more like, please don't do anything that's going to cause this stuff to happen. It's the way more that's presented, but we've talked about before. The first mitzvah that's mentioned in the portion is the mitzvah of Bikurim, the offering of the first fruits during temple times. People grew stuff on their properties, and Israel was an agronomy and economy, which it was pretty much until the 1990s. And they would collect their first fruit. Anything that's first belongs to God. There's a whole way in which they did determine what was first and how it was first and how they would collect it. And then they would make a whole big parade, and they'd march down to Jerusalem, and they would present it to the Kohanim, where they were offered, and everybody had a big party. And yes, everything was wonderful. It was usually done on the holiday of Shavuos, the Feast of the Pentecost. Let's look at it in a modern light, since, okay, I do have fruit trees. I am growing stuff. We are growing stuff in Ferndale. And we have grapes growing, which that's one of the seven species for which Israel is praised. We don't have dates, olives, pomegranates, wheat, barley. That's it. Our figs growing on the property, but we do have grapes. So being that that would be the case, and if we were living in Israel, we would, during temple times, we'd have to take the first of those fruits, put them in a basket, and march down to Jerusalem and offer them with everybody else's. But since I'm not doing that, and it's really very interesting that of our grapevine, the grapes are such that most people come and they collect the leaves, and they make stuffed grape leaves rather than eating the grapes. Talk about having sour grapes or sowing sour grapes, whatever the expression is. We've got some sour grapes over there at Jewish Ferndale. But anyway, so it says when you enter the land, the word land, eretz, is related to the word for will and desire, rutzen. They both have the grammatical root of rutz, eretz and rutzen. Okay, so it says that when you go now, your will has to be that when you decide what you want to do, and it says that which will are we talking about? It says it's the land, which land? The one that God's giving you as an inheritance. So this refers to our godly soul, our animal soul, our body. Our body being the land of Israel per se. It says that when you take possession of it, is what the verse says. So now you have your daily life and your daily routine, and you're being bombarded all day with mundane and profane things. And it says, no, what do you have to do? You have to take the fruit and put it into a basket. What you have to do is invest your time and your energy in turning the mundane into something which, it says, and take it to a place where God will show you. And this indicates that wherever a person may be is not by chance or happenstance or even because you wanted to be there. Everybody is where they are because the Almighty has decided this is where a person needs to be to rectify that part of the world. And that's why each person is where they are. They have their own little shtickle, their own little piece, their own little part of the world, which is for them to rectify. And then what happens is, as you rectify it, you move on, you go someplace else. So here it is now before Rosh Hashanah. And what we're supposed to do is show the Almighty that this year was a good year. Okay, I want to be written in the book. Why should you be written in the book of life for a happy and a healthy new year, which is what we wish everybody? As well, look at the year I had last year. You know, if you're going to say, uh-oh. not like the song suggests. It's like Yom Kippur's coming up and I got to, like, you know, it'll be okay after the end. But we're in the month of Elul now. Our month of Elul is it's a time to make corrections. And every portion in this month, which is read in the synagogue, gives us direct lessons how to correct things. So we see that a person has to look around and say, in this last year, you should do this every day. How did I make today better than yesterday? So that you look around at the end of the year and you say, how is this place that God put me better now than it was last year? And then we can come to Rosh Hashanah and say, listen, God, write me in a book of life. And you know what? You'll have a happy and healthy new year. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard. The Spex Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 1-800-848-2220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Hey, Schlitterman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. If you would like to get in touch with me, easiest way, go to RabbiFinneman.com. There you'll find a direct link to send me an email, no having to look around. You can send me any question, comment, query, criticism, or otherwise to the address listed there at RabbiFinneman.com. And appreciate it. And we answer all of our emails, our fan mail ourselves. You'll also find archived editions of the show for the last, I finally figured it out, it's 200 shows. So if you wanted to see to listen to a show from 5 years ago, I'm sorry, it's too late. And if you want to hear show number 199, you better listen to it sometime this week, because next week it's going to fall off. That's just, I have no control of that. That has to do with something called an RSS link, which my trusty engineer, Luke, could probably tell me more about than I could tell you, because I don't know what that means, but that's what they tell me it is. And it's there. You also find archived editions of other ways in which we present Judaism in various media in an entertaining and educational way. And there's also the very important donations page. We are beholden to you and your good graces. Actually, we're beholden to the Almighty and the Almighty's good graces. And it's only because the Almighty has found it right and fit that the Jewish Hour has been continuing now for 26 years. We're doing this. And the Almighty has made you a conduit. You've been listening to the show now for 51 minutes and 45 minutes, actually. You've been listening for 45 minutes. And if you've gotten this far, it means you like listening to it, because I know what happens if I get tired of listening to something. I just switch the channel. It's really easy. So if you've been listening and you're waiting in anxious anticipation for the story that I'm going to tell, which if the bills were paid, I could tell a longer story. I wouldn't have to do this. I wouldn't have to stand up here and go through this whole routine. But the Jewish Hour is part of a 501(c) corporation, so your donations would be tax deductible. It is also can be deducted from your tithe, which you have to get all your tithes done before Rosh Hashanah. Make sure your 10% of your net income after taxes has been given away to charity. That's the basic rule. You can give more if you want. And go to RabbiFinneman.com, hit donations. Decide what it is that you want to give. You can make it a monthly donation. That's fine. And I guarantee that if you do, you'll be received divine blessing 100%. And at least you'll be able to enjoy the Jewish Hour for another month, because it'll be paid for and you'll be able to tune in. Don't like internet giving? I understand. Send your donation of any amount to the Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Our story actually happened all not that long ago. I think it happened right before COVID. The story is told by Rabbi Peretz Chayne and his wife Chana, who are the director of the Chabad House of Brandeis. So he writes that they were walking up Amsterdam Avenue, New York, after they had an alumni brunch in New York, because I suppose lots of people who go to Brandeis wind up in Manhattan, like, duh. Okay, so they realized they were kind of stuck, so they called for an Uber. And they got into the Uber, so the Uber driver was an older white woman. And so she asked the Uber driver, "Where are you from?" So they said, "Well, we live in the Boston area, but we're from Brooklyn." And she, of course, says, this is like Jewish geography. I said, "So where in Brooklyn?" She said, "We're from Crown Heights." She says, "I'm from Crown Heights." She says, "That's interesting." She says, "You guys are a bunch of, you're Lubavitchers, right?" She says that when I was a little girl, I had the opportunity to sit on the lap of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, who passed away in 1950, which that's way cool. And then she said, "But I have one very special rabbi who I was like my rabbi. He was a gentleman who just came with his family from Europe, in the 40s, and they lived very close by with him. And for a while, they stayed in our house, and he was a grandfather to me. And his name was Zalman Schneerson. He was a cousin of the Rebbe. He says, "Do you know him?" And Chani, Mrs. Hain, said, "Yeah, that's my great-grandfather." So talk about a little bit of Jewish geography over here and what everything is. So that's going to do it for the show today. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.